Talking landscape photography with Kristen Fletcher and Carwin.
He has been described as one of the most creative visual artists working today in the world. Joining us live from Maine in the United States is John Paul Caponegro. Welcome to Light Minded, John.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. Nice to meet you guys.
How are you? Yeah, it's so good to be chatting. I've been a fan of your work for a long time, and obviously your educational stuff, your teaching and your lectures and stuff like that. And it was always on the back of my mind, oh, we've got to get John Paul on to have a chat, because you are, you know, a bit of a legend in the photography world, and definitely in my photography world. And I even actually use a sharpening technique that you have taught, and I call it the JPC sharpening, and it's an action on all my computers, and whenever I want to sharpen an image, I just go straight to that. And so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you for all that. That's high praise. And you know, as I said before, I've been following your work for quite some time, and I look forward to meeting you face to face and maybe stepping on Australian soil one day.
Mate, we'd love to have you too. We'd love to have you. Mine.
Yeah. So you're in Maine. You're in that beautiful state up in the northeast of America. I've been through there. In fact, I actually had my hair dyed in a general store that had toilets and showers in the back, and I was traveling America at the time with my girlfriend. We've been there for about 4 months, just living in the back of this van, and I was a kind of a younger guy, and I kind of dyed my hair, and my roots were showing, so I had to get it redone. And so we found this dye in this general store, and we went into the van, and she put it on my head. And then I, because we knew that I had showers there, so I sat in the car for a couple of hours while this dye was, you know, getting, you know, doing its thing, and then went in and went to the shower and washed it off and came out with kind of blondy orange hair. So
that is an amazing anecdote. Were you going through a Green Day phase, Fletch, at the time?
Yeah. Well, it was back in the, that was the 2000 it was. So it was, you know, grunge was still big in my life. So it was definitely a bit of the Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains vibe that was going on. I'm not sure what you were doing in 2000. What was happening in your world, John Paul?
I was a year away from having my first son. My son, the other one, yeah. So, yeah. 99 was a good, productive year. Yeah. Hunkering down and getting work done as usual, but then also doing the workshops. Yeah. I think I'd have to look. 2000 might be the year that my book, Adobe Photoshop Masterclass, came out.
Oh, okay.
So I might have been finishing that up and looking towards the second edition.
Yeah. So how long have you been taking photographs for? What's your history?
How far back you want to go?
We want to go right back to the start. Got plenty of time.
It started when I was 5 in Ireland, watching my father use his view camera and playing with my mother with her 35mm camera. Yeah. We were reading all the Irish fairy tales, and we saw a black cat running through the hedgerows, which all black animals are spirit animals. And my mother fired off half a dozen shots for it, went into the hedgerows. Yeah. Wasn't until maybe 4 or 5 weeks later that we got back from Ireland. Mom got her 3x5s from the drugstore. She starts flipping through them, and she can't find the cat. I remember her doing a triple take, that is, flipping through that stack of photos for three rounds. Couldn't find the cat. That's probably when I got fascinated by, you know, how do you have this memory? It doesn't quite get captured. You defer a lot of your memory to the photograph. Always interested, but I was drawing and painting ever since I was tiny. When we first moved over to Ireland, Dad got a Guggenheim grant to photograph the megalithic monuments. I was one. I believe those are some of my earliest memories of getting on the boat, taking the car across on the ferry, getting into our new apartment and taking up mural making and almost getting us kicked out. My parents were great. They just put lots of paper on every wall around the room. Basically, paper trained me at a young age. And said, hey, kid, here, on the paper, not on the wall. So drawing and painting, something I just started doing before I could talk. And you know, when I did a little soul searching, what are you going to do with your life, young man? And decided where to go to college and what kind of major would you do? So, you know, there's something I've been doing all my life, which has been drawing.
Yeah.
And I need to go someplace that can satisfy the possible marine biologist in me. Yeah. Boy, I was obsessed with Arthur C. Clarke's writing on the undersea, John Lilly stuff about animal intelligence. I wanted to study that Day of the Dolphin movie. And I can't believe I've never been down to the Barrier Reef, but, you know, ever since I was in my teens, my mother had been threatening to, if I got one more aquarium, she would lock the door and fill my room up with water. It's for a kid in the desert of New Mexico.
That's quite a novel punishment.
Yeah, it would be great, right? Just make sure there's a little air up top and it'd be just fine, right?
Were you born in Ireland?
No, I was born in Boston. So the first year there, but then we moved over for the next year, and dad went every year for the next 8-10 years as part of his Megalist project. And we had met many times afterwards as well. It's one of his favorite places, and I've spent quite a bit of time over there as well.
Mm. Yeah. And so he was a photographer of some note back in those days. Was that his full-time occupation?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Scratching a living by. You know, one of my favorite stories is back in the late 50s. I wasn't around at this point, but dad would tell the stories. He and Aslanders are sitting in a cafe or a coffee place in New York. You got $50 for a photograph from the Museum of Modern Art? Mazel tov. Apparently, Ansel called dad up a couple of years later. How could you possibly charge them $100? You're inflating the market.
Really?
Wow.
You know, so back in the day, but the notion of a fine art photographer, you know, as a living, it wasn't a living. It was a whole other thing. You did commercial work. Ansel did commercial work. Dad did commercial work. Mm-hmm. And you kind of scratched it by. But boy, were there interesting times and interesting people.
Yeah.
And you know, I was a kid around all of that. And it was great. Great. Great to see dad teach out at the Ansel Adams workshop, hear the conversations in the evenings.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I went to school and studied art and literature, but I studied photography in the summers with my father, and really didn't get into photography as my primary medium until Photoshop.
Yeah.
That was 1990, and it was just the right combination. It would satisfy the surrealist in me, the person who wanted to make an image that was in his mind, make that come real, true. Mm. Yeah. Touchable, tangible.
How did you discover Photoshop back in the day?
Gosh, I think it discovered me. Kodak set up their digital training center for creative imaging, 6 months after I moved to Maine. Now, Maine had always been a summer place because of the Maine photo workshops. Mm. And that is ultimately what brought dad up. When I was 5 years old, he started teaching at the new institution there. And so that's the reason why Kodak had come up in that area, but ultimately became a separate entity. Mm-hmm. And there it was, this state-of-the-art training center that there was nothing like it in the rest of the world. Photoshop was brand new. There were also Silicon Graphics machines and brand new, what was it? The XL7700 was Kodak's dye sub machine that they, printer that they pulled off the spy planes. They needed images faster than silver could give them. Yeah. So we had those kinds of things, and I got to be an artist in residence there. Okay. So my second mortgage was a Macintosh and a drum scanner.
Yeah, is that right? And were you shooting large format like your father back then, or was it medium format or 35 mil?
I thought shot both 35 and large format, but primarily 35, because I realized along the way that I just wasn't taking certain walks. Mm. I wasn't having certain experiences because of all the gear.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, was it Rod Dresser's maxim? No photograph is worth taking this more than 50 feet from the car.
sounds like Christian Fletcher.
That just wasn't me. You know, part of making the photograph is taking the walk. Mm. You got to go places. It's got to get into the land and get it into you in a different way.
Of course, I mean, you always see those photos of Ansel Adams with that massive, massive camera and the hikes into the bush to take the shot, and he, you know, sort of gets one or two frames and. You can understand not wanting to go through that.
Yeah, you know, and nobody ever mentions the name of his mule.
Oh.
He had a mule?
Once in a while he would use a mule, yes.
Seriously?
Seriously, yeah.
What was the name of his mule?
I don't know.
Wow, yeah, there you go.
That was fascinating. Kenro Izu, I don't know if you know his work, he's a beautiful Japanese photographer, lives over here in New York. Mm. I remember talking to him maybe a decade ago. He was going up into Mustang, and he was up there for a month, and he shoots a custom-made Deerdorf view camera that's, I don't know, it's 11 by 16 or some strange format like that. But they're big sheets. Yeah. So he's going up there for 30 days with 30 sheets. He can make one exposure a day.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. It's a different mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is so much. Would you prefer film over digital, or are you happy with digital now?
I love digital.
Yeah.
Yeah, no film. No. That's what happens, you know, first thing in the morning on my teeth. I got a toothbrush for it.
We're a bit slow. We're a bit slow.
Good to hear.
Yeah, you know, silver gelatin printing paper, gorgeous. Mm-hmm. You know, all the alternative processes that you know, everybody thought digital was going to kill analog and antique processes, when in fact it's created a resurgence, because now we can make these fabulous inkjet contact negatives for cyanotype and platinum and gum bichromate. I mean, there's been a renaissance in that. I mean, some of the best platinum prints ever made are being made today.
Yeah.
So I love those printing materials. But actually shooting with film, no. I mean, the quality's there in the digital capture.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm actually right now going through, and we're scanning some of Dad's finished prints for a special project, because he needed to make some extra negatives for other people to make all of these prints. But in the process, he's seen how quickly he's able to make the prints. He's printing these new negs is a whole lot easier, because it's already got his dodging and burning. And we've done a little bit of that stuff on the computer sitting side by side. It's taken a little bit of scotch, but you know, we've done well. Anyway, he's getting hooked. He wants more and more digital negs. You know, when I say negs, though, we're getting him a continuous tone neg that he puts back into his old enlarger and goes right back out to what he's been printing with his whole life, solar gelatin.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. So, I mean, you've got an amazing history then. So you, through your father and your upbringing, you would have met so many of the legendary photographers, and I'm sure they would have shaped who you are today. You're also, you're quite the environmentalist, looking at your website. Obviously, you know, photography does help you with that, because you do go out, especially doing landscapes, you go out and into nature. When did you start to think more about the environment? Was that something that just happened from day one?
It's something I feel like I was immersed in from day one. We always lived in rural environments. I spent hours in it, but I think as something that was social or political, that really came to my mind in sharper focus. First, meeting Ansel, and second, spending a lot of time with Elliot Porter. Mm. A lot of people overlook how much my mother exposed me to other artists, George O'Keefe, just the list goes on. But she spent a lot of time doing a lot of Elliot Porter's books, and I, as a young man, got to have these really interesting long conversations with Elliot. Elliot, you know, he's in his 70s or 80s, and I'm in my teens. But he's still interested in my opinion. He's constantly challenging me to support my opinions. Yeah. And there's an environmental advocate. Wow. But he also described his, a place no one knew, his Glen Canyon project, as a eulogy. And it was fascinating to have this conversation with Robert Glenn Ketchum years later. He described that to Robert the same way. And we both reacted to that kind of strongly. Now, for me, it was different. Robert became this kind of tireless advocate and would testify before Congress. I think he was critical in getting the name of the Tongass National Park over here. Tongass, a Native American word. Mm. You know, became ultimately the photographic curator of the National Parks collection for a while. He's done a lot of great advocacy, inspired by that. I feel like it's not going to be too late. I'm going to do something soon enough to make a difference. Mm. And I walked away from it feeling, you know, what Ansel and Elliot are doing is fantastic, and we need more people like that. And they've paved a road for so many, a tradition that we need to continue, but they keep losing the battle. And I'm looking for other ways to get people engaged in the environment, mm-hmm. and not see themselves as separate or something that it needs to be saved, but we need to become more deeply immersed. We need to be thinking about the quality of the life we want to have. We're saving ourselves, our habitable environment. Mm. I love the biologist Lovelock, who constantly is asked to become part of these environmental organizations, and he's like, we got to save the planet. He says, you got to change your rhetoric before we go here. It's not about saving the planet. It's about saving your habitable environment, which are exactly the words that Elliot leveled at me one evening after a long conversation. He says, you know, it's going to be your generation that decides whether you hand on a habitable environment to future generations or not.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, no pressure, Elliot.
Yeah, thanks. Well, my kids now are 17 and 15, and they're blaming me for you know my generation for not doing enough, and it's hard on them, and I think they're more aware than we ever were growing up, but it's so hard. How do we get people to connect more with nature? Is it obviously through our art? We show people beautiful photos of beautiful places, but Is there another way, do you know, that can get people out and appreciate it and want to conserve it?
Well, I'm trying a number of things, and I do think there are a lot of ways, but I think we need to be as creative about solving this issue, challenge, or being engaged with it in a really vibrant way as other things, and realize that all those organizations and their credos have done a lot. It's really important to have over here our clean air, clean water, all of these acts that I've been writing letters. I think I've written more letters in the last 4 years to my representatives than I ever have in my life because of the current administration's foul environmental practices. I think that there are ways of teaching. Do we dare call it environmental literacy or a nature literacy, a way of ways of interacting, ways of thinking about and talking about the environment?
We might have to, though, because, look, it's one of those things, you know, whether you believe in climate change or not, you know, I think Tony Hewitt said it, I've quoted it a couple of times, like, even if you're not a full believer, is it really going to hurt to do the right thing anyway? And, you know, a lot of people don't actually know how to do the right thing.
Yeah. And in the face of all of this, and the current, you know, send your $25 to the Sierra Club just doesn't seem good enough, big enough. I do think that we're in many ways disconnected and that we need to look for ways of becoming more connected, more deeply immersed in the natural environment and simply more aware of how we are immersed in this matrix of life, that we're not separate from it. And
no, that's right.
We're all listening to the language. It's in our very language. How do we move away from it and towards us or we? And if we actually spoke to nature as if it were an extension of us, if we were more like the New Zealanders who grant a river the rights of a person, that was an amazing piece of legislation last year, right? What's the mentality behind that, and does it lead to a more sustainable and more sustainable future and a more fulfilling present? I think that we're really missing out as a culture on some really deeply fulfilling experiences out in nature, and part of it is just shifting our mindset, being more mindful. Even if you just look at what's on your table, what you're putting in your body, how you breathe, with water you drink, where it comes from, and really savor that. I think that there's a sense of connectedness, of appreciation, of gratitude that can follow from simply doing the things we are already doing in a more mindful way.
Do you think?
I also think we get more creative.
Do you think with your photography, your environmental stance comes through as a theme in your imagery?
Yeah, 100%, but I don't think it's effective enough. You know, and I think a lot of advocates in photography, you know, they put their work out and they think, well, you know, it got published, it's made a difference. But has it? How effective is it? Or is it just the latest story that flashes by in 6 seconds? And what kind of change does it really affect? And I've been asking myself these questions all my life, and I've turned to writing this year pretty intensely. I'm writing a nonfiction book about mindfulness practices in nature. And I've been writing a lot of eco poetry.
Can you share some with us, some eco poetry?
You want me to read you something?
Yeah, please.
I could probably read you something there. Yeah. I luckily have some of the things printed out in here. We probably want to do a short one, and should we do a happy one or a dark one?
Let's do a happy one. And actually, before we do this, can I just say we've never had poetry on Light Minded ever before. So this
no,
is
we
first.
Haven't.
All right, I'm going to do a middle of the road. Okay. I was kind of middle of the road. I've been writing this book. It's really two books in one. I first titled it How to Love the Earth, and then the other book was How Not to Love the Earth. Now it's just one title, and the knot is scratched off. Yeah. So it goes through process. And this one actually gets back to the language we were just talking about. So it came to hand, and we're just going to go with that bit of staccomacy. It's called I, You, They, Us, We. Why must we capitalize I when we don't capitalize you or they or we or us? If I had to capitalize just one of these, I'd choose we, not I. Or capitalize them all, with respect. Maybe it's better to capitalize none of them. Not that they're not all special, but let's just not make such a big deal of them. What would happen if we only used we for a day, a week, a month, or a year? My joys and sorrows would be yours. Your joys and sorrows would be mine. We'd share a common past, present, and future. Our time would be ours, not just yours, not just mine. It's not that I want you to be me or me to be you. I love the differences. I'd like to get to really know them, celebrate them. It is that I'd like to clear the air, see you and be seen by you truly, hear you and be heard fully. Stop building walls and build more bridges, beautifully. Those walls we build around ourselves from the our world. Just imagine what could happen if we stopped calling in it and instead called it we and really let each other, us, in. That's the future. No, the present I hope for so that we can build a better future, present, together. I'd like to give this gift to you, to them, to us, to we. Will you give this gift to me, to us, to we?
Yeah.
All right, it's a start.
That's beautiful.
I don't know what was better, the poetry or the voice, John Paul. That was amazing.
Yeah, you've definitely got a good voice for that sort of thing. I was actually finding myself getting quite relaxed. You could do. Have you done any meditation tapes? Because I think you'd do that pretty well.
I haven't. Yeah, Greg Heiser, my friend, always teases me whenever he leaves a message on the phone. He says, "Radio, baby, radio."
John, I've got a question for you. Should artists make bold statements in their work?
I think it really depends on the artist. Some artists aren't called to that. Don't have that. I don't want to say talent because these are skills like anything else that can be learned. But I do feel like some artists are better silent. It's just a personal choice. Mm. On the other hand, when dealing with my students and I recommend that they write, I know there's a lot of resistance because, you know, there are a lot of myths in photography, like pictures should be seen and not heard.
Mm.
Does that really mean that the photographer should remain mute? I don't think so. Look at Van Gogh. Anybody talks about Van Gogh, they have to look at the letters. They have to look at the journals. They can't just sort of write them off. He said some things that were important to him. He didn't say everything, but he said a lot, and it helps. I do think that there are specific ways of writing that are more open rather than closed. I think one of the worst things to do is kind of set up an equation, X plus Y equals Z. So if I write this, now you understand the work and that's all the work is about. And I think that's some of the resistance some people have, some artists have, to talking about their work. They think that, okay, once you've said something, that's all anybody will ever see. But I think if you speak in certain kinds of ways, you can open up doors and windows, but not stop the searching that's so important in any art experience.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think that's something that people do struggle with. I can speak for myself in that I would love to be able to write about my work that I don't admit whether I have the confidence to do that or whether I feel like I'm relevant, you know, or anyone really cares about my opinion. Mm. You know, my whole photography career has been about, you know, creating pretty decor photos to you know, to make people's homes look more, you know, livable. But I've never really sort of thought about the writing. And I looked at your website and I looked at your writings, and it reminded me of a good friend of ours, a guy named Les Walkling, who is a bit of an academic, and he's you know, genius, basically one of the smartest guys we've gotten in Australia involved in photography and art and colour management, all those things that you do as well. And he places a lot of importance on writing. So it's really cool to actually see what you do and how you talk about things, and, you know, watching your slideshows and of your images and your narration over them. I think it's really awesome. So how would you describe your style?
You mean in one phrase?
Well, yeah, or many phrases. I mean, because you know, there's a lot of composites and stuff like that. The work's very, very minimal.
Let me zag here. It's virtual environmental art.
Yep.
You know, I make virtual petroglyphs and virtual paths because I don't want to mark the land for future generations. Yeah. But I do want to have that relationship with land. Yeah. So, you know, I walk it. I try and leave no trace. And I come back and I make my traces for myself, anybody who wants to share them. But this land is still there for others.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, it's quite original, your work. Where does the inspiration come from?
So many places. You know, one of the primary influences has been a lot of tribal cultures or primal cultures. You know, as a kid growing up in New Mexico, I was very influenced by the Native Americans. I collected a lot of their Kachinas are sacred dolls of the of the gods. They will take these cottonwood roots and carve them into these small statues of the different gods. Mm. I read a lot of the myths, and during college, I read a lot of Joseph Campbell and all the myths behind it. Those sacred stories are what excited me the most. And whether it was the specific or literal material within that was so dreamlike, or, you know, some of these symmetries that I make are very mandala like, or they look like totem poles, or whether it was the relationship with land that they showed. And I think you find that a lot in Celtic culture. I think, you know, down under, you've got quite a tradition down there as well. Mm. So some beautiful sentiments about being a part of land. I think those are tremendously inspiring to me, and so that becomes a wellspring. Jerry Osman, it was funny, he and I were having a conversation. I did for a long while for Camera Arts and View Camera. I would have these conversations with other photographers, about 50 of them on my website. So here's Jerry, you know, now called the grandfather of or godfather of Photoshop, which is, puts a chuckle on his face, and, you know, I laugh with him. He's saying, you know, I used to say, how do you feel about this surreal label? I mean, it was a pretty short-lived movement in the 20th century. Don't you think we're working on something longer? He says, absolutely, but I'm not sure what we call it. Mm. What do we call it? Visionary? Do we call it dreamlike? What do we call it? You know, and there again, points to language. Mm. Language is often clear thinking, and if you have certain concepts, that language can be very helpful to communicate with others, but also to communicate inside yourself. And if you're lacking language, you're painting with a more limited palette. So,
yeah. You talk about authentic creativity, that's probably a really hard concept for people, for artists to grasp. And what is, you know, what is your authentic self? What is it in your art that is truly you? How do you, with your work, do you consider that it's authentic to who you are as a person? Is it, or is, because I mean, I struggle with this all the time, and I wanted to talk to you about, like, how do you get past the kind of copying the, you see the stuff that over and over it's been done. You know, how do you find what it is in yourself that's authentic? Is that a question?
Yeah, no, it's a really important, rich question that, you know, we can't answer definitively, but we could certainly put a couple of dents in that. I mean, the first thing I would do is kick the habit of originality. Mm-hmm. This notion that something has to be novel, look completely new to be your own. Mm-hmm. That's just design engineering. It may or may not be authentic. That's one of the reasons I emphasize that notion of authenticity, something that comes out of the fiber of your being, out of the life that you live. And it might be quite traditional, but it could also be very authentic. You know, and I think many Asian cultures have a much better appreciation for this. I think when you there's a lot of ways of getting into this. Let me zag real quick. One of the things I absolutely loved is I was having a conversation with Emmett Gowan, a wonderful photographer, and he made this fabulous statement. He said, you know, I had to lose a lot of Robert Frank to find Emmett Gowan. You know, I was amazed to read an interview of Chuck Close saying that as he was going through his graduate studies, he just emulated de Kooning nonstop.
Yes,
he felt he could make a de Kooning easily, but he needed to do all of that to find, you know, super realist Chuck Close. But then when you get up close on his more recent late canvases and you see all that brushwork for each of the cells, say, oh, this makes quite a bit of sense. So I think often we gravitate towards work by other artists that we relate to. Sometimes it's just even one or two or three images they make, maybe not their whole body of work. But there's a kind of a kinship with the work that's done. There are aspects or qualities of that we're really pulled towards. And I think we're beginning on that path that Joseph Campbell talks about, following your bliss. And so what is that bliss? And I think if you find the work that you would do, regardless of whether it would sell, the work that you're called to do, and go deep with that, get curious about that, sustain a relationship with that. I think it's easy to get the one shot and then kind of move on. I think once you get into a territory that's exciting, then if you can develop a relationship with that material, with yourself, with that way of being, because I think the seeing is an extension of a way of being, then you're fostering your own growth. And in this respect, I think it's quite a lot like Blake talking about us being co-creators. We become very proactive in who we become. You know, you are what you do. And so if you do a lot of what you love, you become more like what you love.
Yeah.
I would go there, but I do think it's very useful to be mindful of why we make these decisions. In that respect, I would say, you know, if you don't have a long meditation practice, and I would recommend it, I'm not meditating for long times. I'm a big believer in spot meditation, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, or just the daily mindfulness. But if you don't have that, then just go back to being three. You know, 3-year-olds are just infuriating in how many questions they ask. Ask a ton of questions. Ask yourself questions, but not in a challenging way, not in a way that you have to justify yourself, not putting yourself on the spot, just like, hey, what's going on? Why'd you do that? Oh, okay, that's interesting. Where'd that come from? It gives you more to work with. Instead of going through things unconsciously, you become a little bit more aware of how the influences are flowing with you, what you're reacting to, how you tend to react more often than not, what situations tend to light you up. Those are the kinds of things that kind of like a hunter, you start tracking yourself. And And it is probably the greatest adventure.
It's so true. We get so caught up in the business of making money from photography. Well, I do, I go into my gallery and the girls are asking, oh, we need this done, we need that done, and we got to get this email out. We haven't got any photos of this beach. Can you make sure you get some? Blah blah blah. And oh, we've run out of paper. Can you order some more? Or you know, the computer's not working. And yeah, you know, it just builds on itself. So yeah, it just happens. And we're going through a very busy period here in Dunsborough at the moment where I live, because of all the lockdowns and because no one from Australia can go out of the country. They're all they're all coming and holidaying locally, and we're just getting this huge influx of people. So all this creativity kind of goes out the door because you're basically spending most of your time trying to maintain the business
and chasing your ass,
and that makes it so hard. But I like the idea of meditation, but I can't say that I've actually ever done any. And I think and this is probably for a lot of photographers, going actually out and photographing is meditation in some respects, because you know that's where you can find your little place out in the bush and just be focused on what it is you want to capture, and you, everything else, for me anyway, everything else just disappears. Do you get much time to take photographs? Are you caught up in everyday stuff as well?
Yes. You know, it comes in spurts. I do a lot of photographing in all these workshops that I do. Yep. And I try and carve out a few days ahead or after these trips as well to be able to photograph on my own. And it's a different rhythm, different mind, different pace. So I do photograph, but I relate to all of the pulls of running a business that you're talking about, and how that can drain away from getting into that creative mindset. And I kind of feel for you. And I feel like we all need, they're calling COVID the great pause. Yeah. I feel like we all need pauses at different points in our life, and maybe a shorter pause every year. I've been telling myself that I need 4 weeks. Wouldn't that be luxurious? Just 4 weeks to do nothing but create. Wouldn't that be awesome? It always gets cannibalized, right? The great pause, and my workshops are getting canceled, and I'm not traveling, and it may be just trying to rationalize my next pause in 2022 and 2023. This has been the most creative year of my life.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been going anywhere.
Yeah.
And I've made 200 images and written a quarter of a nonfiction book and written 3 books of poetry and all kinds of other things. It's been a tremendously productive time because I haven't had as many of those pulls, and I've given myself permission to just sort of tune that stuff out.
Yeah.
And in part because I think creativity really kind of fills you up. Inspires you, keeps your energy up, and keeps you going. And in such dark times, with all of this grief out there, I mean, all these people dying, all these people sick, all these people out of work, it's heavy when you listen to the news. You feel for people, and you know, sure, I've got little challenges, but they're little in comparison to what other people have, and I'm so grateful for what I have.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make the most of the time that I do have.
Yeah.
But having the time to be this creative has been, let's just say, it's filling me up, making me stronger to be able to approach the next year, satisfying many life goals. It's been a profoundly influential time for me.
John, what are your life goals?
I would love to be able to say that I was a contributor, not just a contender. You know, it's nice that my work is in the Smithsonian. If I could actually make a difference in people's lives, in the way that we walk this planet, if I could help others find their own creative wellsprings and make their own contributions, that would be an even bigger contribution to me. But I can't guarantee that. Who knows? You can't rely on other people for that. And so when I look at my life and what I would like to accomplish, you know, I'd like to become more compassionate and more deeply immersed in the natural world and have more of the kinds of experiences that I've been blessed to have. And I don't just mean traveling to Antarctica. I mean also dreaming with it. I don't mean just being able to go to the American desert Southwest. I mean being able to really walk in a deeply immersive way with it and have a conversation with some friends about that that might have had a similar experience, but maybe a little different too. You know, I'd like to know that having walked this earth, I made a difference for it and for others.
Do you think you're close to achieving your goals?
No. No, I mean, I'm really happy with the images that I make. I think they're beautiful. I think they're authentic. I think I need to get my marketing game on, and I think I need to get my message out there in a much more effective way, and that means in different kinds of channels. I do think that in the teaching other photographers, being able to share things on creativity, helping others, that I know it made a difference for a lot of different people's lives. So in that respect, the teaching is tremendously fulfilling because I can see other people light up, and I got to be a catalyst for them setting themselves on fire.
What's a typical day in a workshop with you? Is it, because you do so many different things? Obviously, you've got your environmental stuff, you've got your amazing technical skills. When people come along to one of your workshops, do you talk about all these deeper things as well? Is that part of what you do?
This happens by the fire with scotch or whiskey or wine, or, you know, this is kind of the after hours conversations. These are the waiting for everybody to return from the trails while you're standing in the parking lot. Yeah. This happens on one-on-one reviews of people's work. Yeah. It's not like there's a grand how to connect with nature lecture in my curriculum. I tend to take a much lighter, softer touch, but I do slip these concerns in there, and I definitely pull out questions, techniques, exercises that encourage people to find their own ways. It's not like I want to teach them to have my relationship with nature. Mm-hmm. It is that I want to empower them to have a deeper, more authentic relationship with nature, to find their own ways, ways that work for them, ways that light themselves up. So yeah, I slip it in there. But it's in the framework of, let's say that we're out in the field, because the printing workshops are entirely different than the field workshops.
Yeah.
You know, you're out before sunrise, you're on location at sunrise, and you got a good 2-3 hour immersion in a great location. Come back, grab a snack, shower up, get a 20-minute nap. I'm a firm believer in naps. 30 minutes, not 45 minutes. There's a lot of neuroscience behind it. 23% increase in cognitive performance.
Is that true?
Take naps.
So that's a power nap, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a power nap, absolutely. It's the kind of the way that Thomas Edison lived. And then after a light lunch, we're into seminars, reviews. And then we're back out on location for the late light, and then we have a great meal, and hopefully a great conversation with, you know, whatever libation you want to have. And we do it all over again, 5-6 days in a row. What I tend to encourage people to do is think about a project that you want to develop. It's really easy to be able to, that's not a good way of saying it. It's easy to fall into the, I got one good one here and I got a good one over there, but I have no idea how they're going to go together. Just the idea of developing a project, and it could be just 12 images that relate to each other. But how do they relate? Now, I always encourage people to make pictures about things, not just of things. So what's the theme? Not just the subject, but what's the theme? You know, we could be photographing the desert. And for me, it might be a love affair. And for somebody else, it might be a wasteland. Mm. All depending on their point of view, not their angle of view, their relationship. Right. Yeah. And so I think the framework of developing a project, whether it's a portfolio or a web gallery or a print-on-demand book, which is so easy to make these days, just that framework of, well, how do these things go together? Starts asking questions about where's your beginning, middle, and end? Where are you going? It's like a book of poetry doesn't have to have a literal story, but it has an arc. It has some momentum. You're going somewhere. You take the viewer, the reader, on a journey. And so just to consider where that could go and how your images work together, how many different creative moves you can make, because there's a lot of opportunity to shape that story. Mm. Two different picture editors could tell entirely different stories with the same pictures. So it's it's a fascinating process. I strongly recommend people take on projects.
Yeah, I can see that in your work, and especially like on your Instagram feed, you have certain themes that run through for a while, and then it changes to something else. And I noticed ones that you're doing a lot of aerials, and I think that's when we spoke. You were getting some aerials from Australia, and how did you get those? Were they sort of a Google Earth type thing? How did you get some of those?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, I joined that community. People are making images with Google Earth.
Here's some information.
Oh, hang on, sorry. Sorry, my phone. I asked Google and it came up. Sorry, stupid phone. Okay, they're listening to us. Go on. So
It doesn't mean we're going to get a reply. I put out a few feelers to some of my buddies about, you know, what are the legalities of being able to sell a fine art print of that? Not like I'm going to license this stuff commercially, because that's a whole other issue. Yeah. And they don't know. They'll figure it out as they go along. But there's a whole bunch of people. I'm one of many who take screenshots of Google Earth, Google Maps, and then enhance them or do something with them.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, I think it's really amazing. It's cool, and you do definitely get a different sense of the aerial photography, because it's obviously so much higher.
Mm. And it's so evenly lit. You know, you don't get to see these things changing with time of day.
Yeah.
It's like this strange universal omnidirectional light.
Yeah,
it's quite fascinating. And then there's the glitches; those are as fascinating too.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and so that's obviously what you do. You start working on a project, or you're working on a series of images that go together, and it's really, really quite obvious in your feed and how it works. And I love scrolling through it, because you can really see those lines between things. So you've got a lot of stuff on Antarctica. Is Antarctica for you? Is that a fairly special place to visit?
It's a tremendously special place for me. It's probably my favorite place on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, I've only gotten to go there 12 times. Only.
Only 12.
It's just sort of gotten into my blood. And, one of the first things I did when I got back from my trip in February, which is just before things started to shut down for COVID, was I had planned to take a month off to, my pause. I said, darn it, this year I'm doing it. And one of the things was I wanted to go through those 12 voyages and pull together my book on Antarctica. Mm. And, so that 1 month turned into six and counting. Yeah. But that first month, I went through everything that I shot again. And at the same time, I was also writing with, I took a private workshop with a local writer who, she recommended Jack Grape's method writing. His two books are really fantastic in terms of finding your voice, and are really super. Mm-hmm. As I was writing a nonfiction book, and I was also writing the copy for the Antarctica book that I wanted to do, and she was encouraging me to show the altered images with the unaltered images, and I wasn't quite sure how to write that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, when she said it, said, yeah, I know a lot of people are going to be thinking about that. And isn't this the book that only you could do? I mean, there's a lot of people who could do great books in Antarctica, straight images, but have the straight and the altered, have them work off each other. Isn't, who else could do that? And, yeah, okay, that's the book I need to do. So that's what I put together this spring.
Yeah.
And I look forward to going back in 2022.
Yeah.
2021 is canceled, of course.
Yeah. Do you when you go there, do you normally go as part of a tour? Are you taking photographers with you and stuff?
Yeah, we do. I've been going with my colleague Seth Resnick. And, we usually go with about 18 people. That's when they'll give us two Zodiacs. We want two Zodiacs because they don't generally like to have one Zodiac go way far out like we like to into the ice fields. They want, in case a Zodiac flips or you have trouble with an engine, there's always a second Zodiac nearby.
Yeah.
So we have to have somewhere between 14 and 18 people with us.
Yeah.
But that's about what we limited to. We did take the entire boat, about 75 people with us, and we brought on three other instructors. But it was much more of a tour than a workshop, and we really like to do workshops, and we like to make contact with the people we travel with. And you just can't do that with 75 people over 10 days. So these smaller, more intense groups, and it'd be much more fulfilling for everybody.
I've only been lucky enough to get down to Antarctica once. That was with Kevin Raber and Michael Reichman, actually. I think it was one of Michael Reichman's last trips. I loved it. But we had issues on the first trip. We couldn't get in because we were flying down down into King George Island, but it was foggy. It was too hot, so there was a fog consistently over the airport, so they couldn't land. So we had three takeoffs, and only one of them landed. So the other two we had to return back into Punta Arenas. So it was a difficult time for those that didn't get to go. Actually, Thomas Knoll was on that trip as well. And he didn't get to go. Guys from Google. It was a who's who of let's go to Antarctica. And anyway, didn't end up too well.
Cancelled,
Thomas Knoll, isn't he the Photoshop inventor?
So you would know him pretty well, would you?
What's that?
You would know Thomas pretty well?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've traveled with him to Antarctica on one of the first three trips that Michael brought us down in 2005. Michael asked a number of us, Jeff Shewee, Seth Resnick, Stephen Johnson, and myself, to co-teach the voyages that he was making. He went back in 2007 and 2009 and then said, look, I'm tired of the seasick, so I'm out. Seth and I started doing our own thing in 2011, but I think Michael did come back to Antarctica because of the fly option. Before he passed, no longer with us, unfortunately.
It was interesting. I've been on a couple of trips with those guys, boat trips, and Kevin Raber loves the rough and tumble of the ocean. And I was on a trip, and it was up in the Kimberley, actually, in Western Australia, and it was really rough, and everyone was getting sick. And this is on a boat called the True North, and Kevin was loving it. He was the only one that was actually smiling. Oh, I love this rough weather. He goes, tie me to the mast and put me up there, and I'll be happy as Larry.
That sounds about right.
he was drinking and carrying on and having a jolly old time. So he doesn't mind the rough weather. On that trip I did to Antarctica was with Art Wolf, was one of the other instructors. And I shared a cabin with Art. Christian, I think I've seen enough icebergs. I've been here 18 times now. And I was going, what? So now you've almost been as many as well. So looks like I need to get back down there myself. But is there anywhere in the world that you haven't been to that you would like to go to? I think you said you've been just about everywhere, haven't you?
No, I really haven't. There's all kinds of places I haven't been. China, a lot of Southeast Asia. I've never been to India. It's high on my list, but I got to tell you, your deserts down there in Australia and the reef, bucket list items, and they're getting higher and higher on that list. I'm going to see you fairly soon.
Have you been to Australia, John Paul?
Never been. No, I've wanted to go since I was a kid, and it just hasn't happened. I mean, sure, I've flown through the airport, but that doesn't count.
Yeah, it's in some parts, in some respects, it's quite similar to the US, but we don't have quite the mountains that you guys have. It's all a bit flatter, but there's areas that look like America. There's areas that look a bit like Africa, and we don't have any animals that are going to kill you. So, unless it's a snake. I mean, a snake will kill you, but, you know, everywhere has snakes.
What about drop bears, Fletch?
Drop bears, yeah. The drop bears, are you got to watch out for those. But yeah, but look, if you like reefs and diving and all that sort of stuff, you need to get over to Western Australia to the Ningaloo Reef, because it's kind of many people talk about it, and it's an amazing reef system that is so much more alive even than the Great Barrier Reef. So if you do come over, you definitely need to go there. You know, they've got the whale sharks and all that sort of stuff, but the reef is so, the waters up there are so alive. You know, all the whales come through there, and they got turtles and all sorts of other bits and pieces. And
awesome.
Plenty of sharks if you like sharks and stuff like that.
Good. Well, I'll give you a ring when I know when I'm coming.
Yeah, and if you like your aerials, there's definitely lots of amazing aerials to be had here in Western Australia, at least.
Yeah, you've been showing some beautiful things online last year.
Tony Hewitt, he did a project where him and another guy flew around the whole coastline of Australia called Girt by Sea. It was an amazing exhibition of work, and some of the aerials they got on that trip were just mind-blowing. I think Tony's probably the master of that here in Australia at the moment. There's a lot of guys doing it, but he always seems to pull something a little bit more out of his images. So yeah, pretty crazy stuff. But look, we'd love to have you over. So what's the future hold for you? Are you obviously your workshops are a little bit slow at the moment, but are you going to continue to keep doing that, keep teaching and inspiring people?
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking a lot about what I bring online, and I think people have developed the Zoom habit. In other words, they're willing to do things online, which opens up a lot of opportunities for me. I probably would have released some of those earlier this fall, except I've just been on a tear making images and writing. But beginning of next year, I got a special mentor program that I'm rebooting in a very limited way. And then some of that online product will happen. Right now I'm in the process of, last year I separated my website. You know, the website is like three books worth of information, 50 interviews. It just keeps going. Yeah. It's been a 15-year project at this point.
Yeah.
And I just needed to carve a separate space for my art, and I've done that. And I'm about to announce a whole new thing where I've created these virtual gallery talks where, you know, I'll show some images and you can play the audio or not if you want to hear what I have to say about the images. And I'm going to be giving away free catalogs on that as well for the exhibition.
That is fantastic, I reckon.
Yeah. So if you go to my website, johnplacapanegro.art, you can get there from .com, but the .art has the galleries. You can sign in for the newsletter. It's actually going out next week, the first issue. And it's going to, we ran into a couple of database issues, but it's actually kind of kismet. I'm going to be featuring the studies, a lot of the drawings, the high contrast photographs, paintings, photographs that I consider studies rather than finished works. Really, how does all of this stuff accrue into the finished work? Kind of the behind the scenes look. So that'll be the first issue, and the next issue will be the altered work that I've done over the last 15 years in Antarctica, all collected. So,
and then
I've got this other series that I made this year, relating a lot to what we were talking earlier about the younger folks blaming the older folks for not doing enough on the climate. I get it. Yeah, I've been sitting on this one for about 10 years and just thinking, you know, this work is just too dark. I'm not sure that it has, you know, is it conscientious to let this environmental nightmare out? But I'm doing it. I made it. A series I'm calling Global Warning. And, you know, it's dark. You know, you zag, you try different things. Maybe this will be the thing that galvanizes a little more attention on the rest of the work or in certain areas. It was fascinating for me to show some of the early images that are related to this to a glaciologist, one of the top glaciologists in the world. Very interesting guy, very well spoken, we were having a great bottle of wine as we're sitting in my gallery, and he's looking at these things, this smoky water, and he says, yeah, don't overlook this. It's not just the straight Antarctica stuff. This has a role to play.
Yeah.
So I got to find out what that is. We'll find out. Stay tuned.
Yeah, fantastic. Mm. Well, how was your mentor program going to work? Is that something, obviously you've done it before, but do you take on like a group of people and works over a certain period of time, or how does that work?
Yeah. You know, Santa Fe and Maine also have these mentor programs where, you know, once a month, once every 3 weeks, you show up online. There are assignments in between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to model it similar to that. Yeah. But having thought about it for a number of years and having had an alumni group, oh, they had a good 50 members for a good 10 years. Mm. I'm really going to make this by invitation, very customized, and really start at the level of the individual and see what their goals are, what their needs are, what how I can help them the most. We're going to make it from the ground up. So I've got all of those ideas about a grand curriculum. And I said, you know, these are individuals. They're at different levels and they have different goals, life goals. Do you have to customize it for that to make the richest experience you can? So I've got my bag of tricks, but then I just got to see what's going to be useful for that person at that moment.
Oh, well, look, I'm already interested. So yeah, as soon as you have it all worked out, and if you're asking, you know, if you need, yeah, because I would love to you know hear more and learn more from what you've gotten, what you've learned over the years.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm at a crossroads at the moment where I'm thinking, well, is it photography that I want to do, or do I want to do something else creative? You know, so. I need help. I'm enjoying watching cars at the moment. That's been, you know, when you think that washing your car is as much fun as taking a photograph, you know, there's some serious stuff going on.
But joking aside, Fletch and I spoke off the air, and he mentioned a couple of weeks ago he seriously enjoyed washing his cars, and a listener actually reached out and gave him some car detailing tips, which I thought was was quite amazing. But John Paul, what advice would you give to somebody going through, I guess you could call it a creative hiatus?
I'd encourage you to reach out and find other work that is inspiring, people work by other people. Another thing that I would encourage, and this is all the time, but I think it can really help in these kinds of times, is make a list of experiments. I have a list on my iPhone. It's just a note of all the different things I want to try. Yeah. Try combining haiku with photographs. Try photographing other people's work so that it looks like your own. What I mean by that is like re-photograph paintings, or I've got a whole series of experiments where I'm photographing postcards that I made of other Maine artists in Maine landscapes. I'm holding the postcard in the landscape and I'm photographing myself holding the postcard.
Cool.
Do I anticipate this becoming my life's work? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Do I have a better sense of the Maine artistic community, how they saw the place that I live in and the home that I live in better as a result of playing? Yeah. And so I'm constantly thinking about things that can challenge me, kind of push me, and trying these things. And the thing about an experiment is like there's not so much pressure on it. It's not like you have to show this stuff. It has to be publication worthy. You have to sell this. Mm-hmm. You're doing it for yourself.
Yeah.
But literally all those Google Earth shots, you saw I posted on my Instagram with my paper borders that says it's a study.
Yeah.
I think now that I'm more than 50 images into this, it is a lot more than a study, and it's starting to become finished work. I'm going to go back and reconsider that stuff. I didn't anticipate making that body of work. I just couldn't travel during COVID. So I got a hold of Google and started traveling virtually and started playing my way in a certain arena. You know, I know my themes. And suddenly it took on a kind of a depth and a resonance that I hadn't anticipated. And I got excited and I could keep it rolling. So sometimes these experiments are just for fun, and other times they become something you never anticipated, and they actually give you a whole new window into yourself and possibly some perspective on other things. They are related to some finished works that I haven't released yet. Yeah. And trying to figure out the relationship between that body of work and this other body of work that's developing is really stimulating. Mm. So I always think of it as like a house of mirrors or a hall of echoes. These same eternal themes within us keep coming around in different shapes, and we don't always have to address them in the same way. In fact, it's probably pretty good to look at them at different angles and listen to them with different ears. Keeps us vital. So I would play a lot more, get curious, make a list of experiments. And when you're feeling dry, go out and play. Take the pressure off. Ask interesting questions. Try things you wouldn't have dared to before.
Yeah.
And keep building that list of experiments.
Mm.
I tell you what, I'm inspired. We've been doing these podcasts for a long time, and I think you're one of the most inspirational people we've had on.
Absolutely.
Time we've been doing it. So, look, thanks so much for your time.
We'll have to do it again, and we'll have a different conversation.
Yeah, I think we could go on forever. But, look, I really appreciate your time, and thank you for staying up late for us. I'm not sure what time it is over there at the moment. But
9:30?
It's only 9:30. Now what am I going to do? I'm going to go play my video game or something.
Yeah. I've got to go to work and answer emails now. So,
yeah.
but thanks again. It's awesome to actually finally get to talk to you, and hopefully we will meet face to face one time soon in the future.
Yeah, I really look forward to it.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to keep an eye on your mentor program, because I think it would be something that would benefit myself and I'm sure everyone. So yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, great.
John Paul Caponegro, thank you very much for joining Like Minded.
Stay well, everybody.